you lived your life like you want your life to be? Did you pass the blame, get lost on a runaway train?
Hello and welcome to the Privileged Man podcast. My name is Esben Baring and I'm your host. On this podcast, you're going to hear about the experiences of men and women who became aware of and found ways to break free from the molds of expectation, to live their lives adventurously and truthfully, and discover their true selves along the way. These sovereign souls are sharing the insights they had that led them to be unapologetically who they are. These conversations are rich with moments of realization, transformation, and insight that can inspire the willingness to look at your life in new and refreshing ways. My guest today is Robert Augustus Masters, PhD. Robert is a pioneering psychotherapist and group leader, relationship expert and psycho-spiritual guide and trainer with a doctorate in psychology. He's also the author of many books, including Transformation Through Intimacy, Spiritual Bypassing, Emotional Intimacy, To Be a Man, and Bringing Your Shadow Out of the Dark, and the audio program, Knowing Your Shadow. His intuitive, uniquely integral work blends the psychological and physical with the emotional and spiritual, with an emphasis on full-blooded embodiment and awakening, emotional authenticity and literacy, deep shadow work, and the development of relational maturity. At essence, his work is about becoming more intimate with all that we are in the service of the deepest possible healing, awakening, and integration. Robert, welcome to the Privileged Man podcast. It's lovely to see your face again after, I think, 5 years. Wow. Just over five years since I came to Ashland to meet you.
That's right.
Well, you know, since we met, I've been on a getting to know myself, I would say. And it's culminated in me creating a movement with a friend called the Privileged Man. Mm. And what we see as true privilege is the possibility to meet our true selves with the willingness to look inward and meet aspects of ourselves that may be hidden. Mm-hmm. And I never understood what it was to be a man. I just assumed that growing up from a boy into a man's body would become something that...
Yeah.
I made some very false assumptions, let's say. And what I've discovered along the way, Robert, is that I was raised in an alcoholic family. And the being raised in an alcoholic family created various aspects of a false self that I used to protect myself, to deny my feelings. I would love to hear just a little bit about how you got into this work, Robert, where your interest started with this work that's led to who you are today and the last 40 years of the book writing.
40 plus years, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to hear how you...
I went into it unknowingly. I was had a lot of heartbreak. There's a relationship breakup. I was in a lot of pain. I go to this group, and I just let myself cut loose. I'd never done it in my life before. It involved some body work, a lot of emotional expression. I felt so at home with it. As soon as the group was over, I started practicing on my friends. I was, you know, not that skilled at the beginning, but I was so enthusiastic. I want to say, we breathe deeper, I'll press here, say this, do that. I led them through it. And before long, I was doing it as a living, making my living doing it. So it grew and grew and grew. And in its current form, it's not because of schooling I've had. It's from all the experience, all the people I've worked with, and refining it. Like now I'm teaching it more and more. I'm doing more trainings where I teach people how to work the way I do without trying to do it exactly like me. There's more of a context, a transmission of that. Here's how to skillfully get to depth quickly using incomplete sentences. Here's how to teach people to move toward their pain. Here's how to look at shadow. Here's how to look at the conditioning that's in someone's shadow. And it's not step by step, it's an art. Like, it's hard for me to describe how I work when I'm training people, but I make an attempt. How do I go from A to B to C? I'm shifting. I'm self-correcting. Like, just start driving a car. The car veers a bit to the right. You self-correct, come back to center, goes to the left. Same with the way I'm working. And it's all intuitive, and it's in my blood. I was natural at it right from the beginning. And at the same time, my writing emerged too. So I wasn't trained in writing either, but I just started doing it. Pretty lurid, crazy stuff at the beginning, but it was pouring out of me. And I forced my friends to listen to me read it. They were a decent audience, and it just kept working. And here I am, my almost 75, I'll be 75 this year, and I'm still, the work is still evolving. It's gotten way more subtle. It's going deeper and deeper. And I feel kinder as I get older, more compassionate. So the space gets even safer. And we're still taking huge risks. I mean, people are coming to me at work at their edge. And there's a lot of trauma. Trauma is central to the work I'm doing. And the working through of trauma.
I love what you said about subtle and the edge. Could you talk a little bit more about a man's edge? Are you talking about his current understanding of where he is, where he feels safe enough to cross, to move across? What do you mean by the edge?
It's the place where growth happens. And but here's the key thing about it. If it's easy, it's not your edge. If it's no big deal, it's not your edge. If you can coast through it, it's not your edge. It's always scary, always scary, but not necessarily in a bad way. But sometimes it can be really scary. And my work with working with people's edges is to approach it very, very skillfully and subtly too. It's not just hammering a person to get at their edge and pushing them over the cliff. Some people have such trauma that I have to work very gently with them, but I'm still intending to take them to that zone of themselves where growth can happen. Right. And I also know that when I do that, I'm going to meet their resistance to doing it. And I've learned over the decades to treat the resistance as something really valuable to explore, often quite tenderly. Someone has a lot of boundaries, and heavy boundaries up, when I take them down too quickly, I'm not serving them. They're just going to pull right back into their shell. So it's more like addressing the numbness, addressing the fear of intimacy without shaming them. But still, there's an invitation to go deeper. And most men and women respond to that invitation. As long as it's not presented as a should or you should be more together, there's no shaming whatsoever, no pressure in the usual sense, but there's an invitation. Here it is. If you dive off this into the zone, I can't guarantee what's going to happen, but it's not going to be boring. It's exciting. Like you found in the group is an excitement, and especially in a group where other people's energies mix in.
Exactly.
It wasn't just me doing my work with you. There were other men interacting with you, and you watching me work with them. And sometimes I had them and you work at the same time, role playing, whatever, psychodrama. So it's like an exciting thing, and it's very creative. That's why I can work as I do at my age now, because it's such a creative process. I don't know what's going to come next. I don't need to know. But it's exciting knowing that we're on a path. We're going somewhere.
And I love that.
Psychological, it can stay physical, somatic, or it can suddenly become spiritual. I see more and more spiritual breakthroughs and openings in my work, even though I'm not going for that. Just dealing with trauma and emotional pain often can rip us open to a deeper reality.
And what does that look like? Could you share an example of a spiritual breakthrough that you've seen in your work?
Well, someone's doing some. So many people I see at the same time when you say that I've worked with, but they're this emotional, they're in grief, they're in agony, they're hurting, they're reliving some abuse, and we're going to the core of it, and they're in touch with the wound without being lost in it, but they are somewhat absorbed in it. Suddenly, I've seen this happen a few times, someone just sits up and goes, "My God, I'm everything." Mm-hmm. And their eyes are wide. Five seconds later, they say, "Oh, I'm nothing."
Wow.
And I'll say, what if both are true? What are both simultaneously true? And it's like this, maybe 10 seconds, a minute, or an hour, there's this opening to one's true nature. Without it being the goal, it's not part of a spiritual path. So it's organic, it's fits, it's grounded.
Wow.
Or gazing in someone's eyes. If I'm looking, I do a lot of work with eyes. There's often like the eyes have different energy and presences. And when they line up, something that person is lit up in both eyes. It's not like their left brain or right brain, their whole brain, and they're present. And it takes like 5 to 10 minutes usually. I had to get very focused when I did big groups when I was younger, because I could not take 15, 20 minutes with some people. They were at such an edge. I had to go into that zone with them through their eyes, through working with one eye at a time. I don't want to explain it here, take up too much of the meeting we're having.
What I'm really interested by is the intergenerational nature of trauma being passed. Hearing you speak just now about shame has been such a big one for me, because I realized that shame was wrapping all of my emotions. So I actually had to come through a layer of shame in order to even
find it. Most men have to face the shame And my job is to do it in a way where I'm not shaming them for having shame. It's more like, okay, we all have shame. Every one of us, and some of us healthy, a lot of it is toxic. And most of us men don't really want to face our shame. We very quickly convert it into dissociation or withdrawal, pulling back, or yeah. We get aggressive as if we're that's the truth of us. But that those are secondary emotions or states. The primary one, here's shame. It's got us by the balls. It's got us by the heart. It doesn't have to. What I often like to do with men is teach them how to sit in their shame without collapsing or crumbling.
Right.
Like if we're friends and you've really hurt me, I don't need you to grovel and beat yourself up in front of me to prove that you're sorry. I want you to stay connected to me, but still feel the shame. Maybe there's something you have to say to me, some amends, and say you're sorry. We got to clean up the mess. But to do it without losing our dignity as men, because a lot of men have lost their dignity. They're walking around, heads hanging, being nice guys, or they're being aggressive assholes, but they're not connected to something tender and vulnerable in them, which is at the heart of shame. When I feel my shame and I express it cleanly, I'm left feeling even more connected, more caring, more tender, but I haven't lost my balls. I haven't lost my spine. I'm still here. Shame is this thing that's the most hidden emotion in psychotherapy and spiritual practice.
And I imagine that's what leads to a lot of spiritual bypassing too, because people want to avoid the shame if they can.
Oh yeah, and the teachers, a lot of spiritual teachers will shame their students for not doing the practices more. They're falling short. Something's wrong with you. Something's wrong with you. Rather than questioning themselves or the teaching. So shame is this huge hidden continent in most of us. And there's so much there. Yeah, and the toxic shame gets the headlines. A lot of people will think all shame is bad, like Brené Brown, like here's this is all this bad thing we have. Yeah, a lot of it is toxic, but like an inner critic that says you should never have been born, you're a bad person, what's wrong with you? But there's a shame when we've hurt someone, we've crossed the line, we've been insensitive. It's important to be able to say, I'm sorry. There's so many people, a lot of men cannot say the words, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Or just go, I'm sorry, come on, get over it. I'm sorry. Get over it. They're not staying with the feeling of it because it's very, very vulnerable.
I've worked this 12-step program called Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families. And what I realize is that shame and fear have been my greatest encapsulations without realizing it.
Yeah.
A huge part of that for me has been in my entitlement, which was really, really cleverly, subtly hidden from me. The sense of superiority, the sense that I was looking down my nose at almost everyone and everything, which was masking a deeper insecurity and a deeper, complete absence of any self-esteem whatsoever. And I was doing some bodywork recently, and what I actually uncovered, the toxic aspect of the shame, Robert, was actually how I was living through racist viewpoints, through sexist viewpoints, through elitist viewpoints, and I wasn't even aware that these were part of me. And I started to question myself, are these beliefs that I picked up in my upbringing, are these beliefs that I'm carrying as a white privileged man throughout generations who's oppressed and looked at minorities to his benefit? And what would you say to that? Because, and what I found in this process, Robert, is that it was so uncomfortable for me to even go and look at that. I resisted. But when I found it, I was vomiting wretch. I was retching the shame. And then it connected me to my heart. And I grieved for about 45 minutes. I sobbed and I sobbed and I sobbed. And I'd rediscovered my heart by going through the agony of that shame.
Yeah.
I couldn't even tell if it was my shame, though, or if it was a collective societal or generative shame. What would you say to that?
Both. It's both. There's your personal shame, based on your own history. Then here's the legacy. Here's the presence of collective shame, collective twisted shame, shame that's been hidden and buried too much. And of course, a lot of men will affect a sense of being superior or, get entitled as a way of pushing away where they don't feel so good about themselves. Like where there's entitlement, there's a sense of insecurity.
Right.
Like to me, when we let go of our sense of entitlement, there's a lot of liberation and we can see other people more. And whatever's racist in us gets minimized. I think the seeds of racism are in everybody. It's just a matter of if they're allowed to sprout and flower.
Right.
But it's so good to get that and to understand that what privilege is, what really is. I mean, you and I have certain privileges a lot of people don't have. And there's other people have privileges we don't have, but there's a sense of being aware of that, bringing it into your field. And when you threw up like that, that to me is the emotion of disgust. I mean, there's disgust at oneself too. Like, look how I've been doing this.
What I found is that from a very young age, my sexual desire was shamed as a little boy, either for having sexual desire or having an erection or feeling attracted to femininity, and that being squashed. What I realized is that around my pelvis area, my hips and my genitals, there'd been psychic numbness my whole life. It was very hard for me to become aroused with a woman because there was a sense that having desire and attraction and arousal for women was somehow shameful. So that area of my body was shut down. So there was a judgment against desire as well that kept me kind of energetically, psychically, emotionally impotent for most of my life. And only now at 44 am I starting to release that shame and discovering a natural arousal. You know, you spoke earlier about alignment of heart, guts, and balls, I think you said in one of your books, and that really starting to ring true to me.
Well, a lot of the work I'm doing with men, women less, but some is about cutting through the tendency to eroticize our old wounds. To let the charge of those early times get eroticized, and we think we're just having normal, healthy sex when we're actually acting out the old melodrama, the old pain, this old suffering. And of course, it's very charged. It can be very exciting, juicy sex, but it's not connected. It's not connected. It's not truly intimate. So there's a lot of healing for us to do around our sexuality, looking at our history. When did we first discover masturbation? What did we do it for? How are we still doing it? Where are we still pornographic? And maybe we're not looking at porn. We may have a pornographic corner in our mind. We tend to revert to it certain times. It's so important. And here's the thing with shame. I've learned, don't shame men for their porn habit, and don't support them in it either. I like to teach men, here's how to outgrow it, and it works. You don't have to, if you're in porn, you're lost in porn, you were the woman, it's a triangle. There's you, her, and the other point of the triangle is the porn habit. You're going to project some of that onto her, have some of that going on behind your forehead when you're having sex. So it's like cleaning up. And one way of doing it that I find is most effective is to explore the non-sexual dynamics that are driving our sexuality, wanting to be wanted, that type of thing, and to see how that is affecting us. If a couple's in trouble sexually, I don't play sex therapists and give them little things to tweak, gimmicks to tweak things with, toys, fantasies to have. I'm teaching them how to connect more by exploring the disconnection they're having. Once they feel emotionally plugged into each other, then sex can flow naturally. It's not like the solution to all the pain of our life. It's just simply an celebration and a sense of already present connection.
Right.
We're already relaxed. We're already loose. We're already connected. We don't have to have sex. We don't have to have an orgasm. And then the connection is the aphrodisiac.
Right. The arousal.
Not the old history, because our history can be very arousing. It can be very negative arousal if we had very painful time as a kid. But when we get sexual with it, when we eroticize it, it can seem positive and it seems kind of maybe kinky and juicy, but we're missing something. We're missing something that's very simple. And also to know yourself, to know your conditioning. I want to say something too around I was in Bali in 1972.
Wow. Long,
50 years ago.
Wow.
And women were all bare-breasted when I was there. And it was not erotic at all. And I would have found it erotic earlier when I was younger. Perhaps when I was there, I saw the men were drawn erotically to the women because of their hip movements, the swaying, that beautiful straight back, and the hips and the dancing. But the breasts, the women's breasts stuck straight out. The old ladies, their breasts hung straight down. They still walked very tall. They're honorable. They'd fed their babies. They'd breastfed for years. Of course they hung down, and there was no implants, there was no gawking. And of course the government of Indonesia was Muslim, so not long after I left there, they started to make kind of, I don't know if it was what type of law it was, but forced the Balinese women to cover themselves up. I'm sure they don't run around knit like that now.
Some of the older women do. Some of the older women still do, yeah. And it's interesting, after I met you and I direction of my path changed. I found myself surrounded by women who embraced these aspects of themselves. They would walk around the house with their breasts out, and it's just normal. Nakedness became much more normal aspect to my life without the eroticism, without the charge. just to appreciate the human body for what it is. But again, the conditioning of our society has sexualized, has objectified the woman's body, so it becomes a something unnatural.
I mean, when I was younger, I remember being in some groups, there were some different groups that were nude. Uncomfortable at first, but what was interesting to me, there was no erotic energy in it because it was very deep encounter group stuff. People were really angry, yelling. It was pretty sloppily done. It was heavy stuff. But there was no focus on, oh, look at her breast, look at his cock. It was, here we are. We're all naked. We're all flawed. No one has a absolutely perfect symmetrical body, and we're all aging too.
Exactly.
We're going to die too. This is going to get older and older. And it was actually good to have that. I didn't need a lot of it, but it was very, very interesting to see that.
Yeah, I love what drew me to you as well when I first discovered you was your use of language and your use of words and your use of poetry and prose to articulate and describe the magnificent, messy wholeness, intimacy of what it is to be alive. Mm. And I realized that sensitivity is I've always been incredibly sensitive, boy and man. And actually how I relate to the world is through feeling and through energy and through emotion. It's my primary way of communicating to the world. Yeah. So I really feel affinity with you to this because I was never given a language or a framework to really become intelligent emotionally about what it is to be a human being, to be a man, to be able to be with my experience and report to you in any single moment what is happening to me without blaming it on you for how I'm experiencing. This is what is happening for me at this moment. A sober way of reporting emotional sobriety.
And you know what you said about the literacy, it's like I think a lot of literacy, and we're talking about working ourselves, comes from being emotionally plugged in. We're emotionally literate. Like if you get me talking about a certain emotion, I can wax poetic around it because there's so much to it. Like anger is not just this thing called anger. There's so many types of anger. There's so many things we do with it. There's such ugly things that are done with it. So much beautiful things are done when it's used as a fire that cuts through relational deadwood and opens us and heals us. And fire is both heat and light, and on you know, it can get very, very beautiful because there's a sense of, like, I'm very in touch with my feelings. I'm very sensitive too. So, and I love poetry. I mean, my last 5-6 books have been published by Sounds True, North Atlantic. The editors are always trying to get me to get a lot of the poetry out of it. It's left to my own devices. I make it pretty wild. I don't care if a sentence goes on for a page. It's one long sentence, Whitman-esque or whatever. So there's a sense that I've just returned to poetry. I just finished a poetry book about 4 days ago. I'm gonna put it up online into all my lists as a free download. I don't care about making money off it. It's poetry. I want to just put it out there. And some of it is bizarre. Some of it is very beautiful. It's a real mixture. But it's lovely to put it out there. That's why I don't know if you're your man's group. I don't have you guys write at the end of the group. Each man write a poem.
We did that, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You remember that?
I do. It's beautiful.
I love seeing each man get up there and share. And some men were quite vulnerable and scared.
Oh.
And it's all beautiful because it says their expression. I had one group, one guy's poem, he got in front of each man and he sang. He just made it up on the spot. And it was wonderful. Someone else did slam poetry. Someone else was crying. I mean, there's a sense of, here we are. We get to express ourselves, and we're not being told this is not a poem. This is not. We're not in school in these square little desks where there's a freedom. And I love seeing men, especially me, more than women, come really alive in group work. Just open up, flow, exactly. And there's usually a sense of brotherhood that forms in that. There's a sense of deep safety. We can say anything.
So, emotional literacy. This is a really. It's a topic and a matter very close to my heart. You spoke just then you touched on anger. And I remember you speaking at some point about different stages and phases of anger, because anger in its healthiest expression can be deeply loving. But you spoke also about anger morphing into aggression, morphing into hostility, morphing into violence and hatred. Yeah. And at some point, anger becomes dehumanizing, where actually you're actually trying to hurt the person in front of you or yourself rather than love. And just even having that awareness and speaking to that shows that there's such a fullness and intimacy to this emotional experience that if we're willing to look and explore, we can understand ourselves more.
Then we become capable of saying, noticing when our anger morphs into aggression. if mine morphs into aggression, it means that when we're a bit pissed off at each other, I will attack you. It's an attack, and you have right to back off from it, protect yourself, because I don't give a shit about you. I just want to put you down, make you wrong. I'm on the war path. That gives anger a bad name, but actually anger is not the problem. It's what we do with it. Turn it into aggression or ill will or hostility. And so much anger does go into aggression, which of course can go into violence. Then we remember we have spiritual teachings that say one moment of anger will destroy 1,000 eons of merit. That's very Buddhist. And that's bullshit too, because the language used there equates anger, ill will, aggression, hatred. It's all translated as the same word in a lot of the old texts. And I take great pains to distinguish anger from aggression. And I can tell if I hardly ever get aggressive with my wife, Diane. But if I do, she feels it instantly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very subtle edge. And I'm very skillful with language, so I can in there. But she can feel the tone, and she'll address it. And I know she's right. She's almost always right about it. And it's not common, or vice versa. Because I've learned that the healthiest anger means, you know, I feel my guts, I feel my jaw, I'm turning a little red, I'm fiery, I'm passionate, but I also care. I have enough caring left in my heart for that person. They feel safe. They know that I'm in danger with me, even though I'm maybe underlining what I'm saying quite emphatically. I'm angry. But in that context, anger and love coexist.
Wow.
That's a great understanding to know that anger and love can coexist. So can compassion. Compassion and anger can coexist. And we have the offspring of that is what I would call fierce compassion, wrathful compassion, a beautiful state to cultivate and to have on tap to protect our boundaries, to protect the integrity of our being.
Wow.
And healthy anger also is always very vulnerable. If I'm really angry, I'm close to tears.
Right.
Not always, but quite often, because I feel vulnerable because there's a wound going on at the same time. Or maybe a caring for the other person that I have to get this heavy with them to get through. If I get too heavy, I'm not getting through. I'm slamming them. They're gonna pull back. So there's so much to be said about using anger skillfully. There's so little taught in our systems here, including educationally, around how to transmit, share healthy anger. And you don't do it by suppressing and just putting a smile on your face and never expressing anger. And I see a couple that says they never fight. I go, boy, you guys are in trouble. Let's look at this.
Wow. Wow. I love what you said about anger being vulnerable and close to tears. Because I reflected on my own experience, and I'm much more likely to be irritable, bordering passive aggressive, than I am to be in a full expression of my vulnerable anger.
The hardest thing to do and the best thing to do in those cases is to say the words, I'm being reactive. I feel reactive. Then shut up. Just stop. That's the hard part, is being quiet at that point.
I suppose it forces us to be with our experience in that moment. It's taking responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to feel those uncomfortable feelings. So on the other side of that, Robert, you know, for me, I spent a long time in my life completely unaware of my emotional experience. So anxiety and depression, mild to moderate depression during my life. And when you talk about the expression of the poems and the song at the end of the men's group, I'm starting to realize that the more that I use my voice and I discover aspects of myself and give them the space to express themselves, my depression and self-expression can't necessarily coexist. On the other side of, you know, unhealthy explosion of unhealthy anger turning into aggression. When anger is suppressed, and when, let's say, come back to that analogy or that metaphor for balls, guts, and hearts in full-blooded alignment, repression, suppression of anger can cause a form of impotence or nice guy syndrome or passivity. Would you talk a little bit to that?
So that's something to consider, is when we suppress our anger, a lot of people do. They've got it. They equate anger expression with danger, based on their early childhood experiences. So their default behavior at those times is to suppress it. But that takes energy. It takes energy to hold it in, and that's inherently depressing. Because depression, to me, the word itself says so much. Depression, to press down. Mm. Someone's depressed. they're pressing down. Maybe their deep grief, their rage, and there's pain and depression, but it's almost like it settles for a lesser fear because it helps you stay away from the really big fears. It keeps you kind of mediocre, flattened, and numb. And it's a hideout. There's a payoff in it. And when we wake up out of depression, we come alive. Now, that said, I think depression is an interesting state to explore for another way. Like if I'm a little depressed, sometimes I like to write when I'm a little depressed because I feel more sober, more in touch. I don't have any rose-colored glasses on. I like what comes out of me. I don't stay depressed. And if I have to get out of it, I can snap out of it very fast. Little yoga, breathing, some meditation, something, or just talking with Diane for 2 minutes, I'll leave that state. But I've learned now I don't have to always leave it so fast. I want to see what's in here. Or if I'm a little numb, what's underneath the numbness? And am I at a 10-degree numb to my numbness? So you treat whatever arises emotionally as worthy of exploration, disgust. I mean, it seems an unpleasant emotion, but still, wow, it's at the as baddest, at its worst, it's at the heart of ethnic cleansing. There's disgust for the other humans, dehumanizing them, so we don't feel any bad in ourselves because we're wiping them out or hurting them deeply.
If we explore a little bit the psycho-spiritual of what you just shared, when we're projecting out all of those shadow aspects of ourselves into our families, our communities, our societies, our countries, our nations.
Yeah.
My sense of myself is that it's an inside job, period. So I am living my own experience when I'm mistakenly believing that everything is happening outside of me. But
yeah,
full integration.
Implicit in that is knowing yourself from the inside deeply, not just intellectually. I mean, you could study emotion intellectually forever and still not be very skilled at expressing it.
Right.
And real integration, and implicit in that, to me, is becoming intimate with everything we are, all these aspects of us. That's shadow work, the core of shadow work, too, like intimate with my own violence, my own this, my own that. Then I'm less likely to act those things out under certain conditions because I know them well. If I don't, I can be the nicest guy on the planet and still behave barbarically at certain times because I'm not in touch with that element. My phrase at that point might be something like, well, that wasn't me. I didn't really mean that. Yes, I did mean it. It's just I'm not in touch with that.
Right.
So there's a kind of radical honesty in this too. Of being here, I am, and I. When I was younger, I thought, well, I'll just work on enough stuff. Some point, I'll be done with it all. I can just rest on the great plateau of enlightenment. I now know that this is an ongoing process. This endless discovery is the menu. You know.
Yeah,
and realization leads to deeper realization. And I'm no longer looking for an end to this, like some final nirvanic rung to hang myself on. It's more like, here I am, and I'm on a journey of endless discovery that may extend well beyond my life. Maybe it's been going on forever. Who knows? I mean, there's a sense of being infinite in our beingness. We go to the core of it. And that's where the mind has to kind of can't operate very well because it can't comprehend in the infinite or God or divine or the pure mystery of this. When I explore anything deeply, I end up facing absolute mystery. And we're into rest in the unknown. That's what I'm teaching people I work with who want to train to be therapists and guides, how to rest in not knowing. And that means resting in the mystery. So if I'm working with someone, I don't know what I'm going to be doing 2 minutes from now, but I've done enough of it. I know that the information I need will come to me as what to do next for that person. It's not a mental decision. It's intuitive. It's not thinking. It's not feeling. It's intuition. And facing me is the mystery. And the older I get, the more intimate I feel with that mystery, even though I don't have a clue. I don't know what it is. How could I? The part of me that wants to figure it out is also the mystery.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And there's an inherent spiritual awakening in that when you embrace that. And I know Diane, my wife, has one of her chants on her CD. She has this called "I Open to the Mystery." That's like a mantra for me, just to open to that. And I keep opening to it, and I can open more and more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. And it's certainly where I'm I'm focusing on my journey right now, Robert. And, you know, I think about societal living, and I was blessed with the good fortune to have an insight that I needed to get away from a societal living to do some exploration in my life. And I've been in Bali for 11 years, giving myself the time and the space to look and feel and understand deeper aspects of myself.
Yeah.
Society doesn't necessarily encourage the types of conversation we're having to be explored in depth and or taught. And so if any man or woman, for that matter, that is listening to this conversation, what would you say to them about perhaps the way they've been conditioned to live and what's possible for them to explore within themselves? Because men's work, I mean, you've been doing it for 40 years or so, and it was very niche, but it's becoming mainstream now because more and more men they're waking up to the fact that there's something more. They're feeling so much emotional pain that something has to be done. So what would you say to people who are listening that might sense that there's something else out there for them?
Well, there's so many things to say, but I mean, but they all fit together. One of them is when you're in pain, turn toward it. Even if it's a tiny, tiny, tiny step, instead of the usual measure of pulling back, medicating ourselves, maybe getting sexual, getting this, getting that, getting intellectual, avoiding it. Because in the heart of the pain is a freedom that doesn't require the absence of pain. And that's real freedom. You don't have to have a pain-free life to be free. You can have a lot of pain and still be free internally. So, and also that we're all conditioned. And the great news, the wonderful news, it'd be just truly be hell if we didn't have this. We can wake up to that conditioning and relate to it differently. It's always with us. Your conditioning's with you, mine's with me, but it's how we relate to it. It is a freedom. And otherwise, our conditioning makes the picks. Our conditioning picks our partner. We wonder why a relationship doesn't work, because we didn't pick the partner. Our conditioning did. And we allowed it to masquerade as us. Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy.
It's like this bizarre puppetry dance. I mean, it's like, come on. There's a possibility of awakening from all of this. But of course, that many humans will take that too far, where they awaken by dissociating from the raw stuff of life. Premature celibacy, rising above pain, thinking you have to go to a monastery to deepen yourself. I mean, intimate relationship can be the monastery. Yeah, everyday life can be it. This is it. This is it. Every shitty thing that happens, just all of it it's all grist for the mill if we use it that way. And we're still going to complain. We're still going to hurt. We're still going to cry and be upset at how unfair life is. And we'll see injustice and hurt. But we're not taken down by it. If we work on ourselves, and working ourselves isn't just doing CBD therapy or just a little bit of tapping, it's more diving into the wound. And that's never easy. It's always painful, but it's so liberating when we go into what's wounding us and we come out the other side. And if you persist, you do come out the other side, where you still hurt, but you don't mind the hurt as much. I hurt more now than I did when I was younger because I'm more sensitive, I'm more attuned.
Right.
But I mind less. I don't care as much. Here's some hurt. It's going to pass. I'm bothered right now. So be it. And that creates a lot of freedom. If you have that attitude when you're working with men in men's groups, you'll find that men feel safer and safer knowing that I don't care what state they're in, it's workable.
Yeah.
It's workable.
I come to seeing the beauty in the pain now, because I know that by coming through, it's going to be, and the expression for me of grief, which I think is what I was resisting for so long, the grief takes me straight back into the depth of my heart and into the mystery. And there's such a tenderness and there's such a rawness and
That's beautiful. You know what? Because the grief rips our heart open.
Yeah,
exactly. There's hell on that, but it's also heaven in that my heart's ripped open and has been ripped open by grief. I feel much more connected to life. I can feel the sap moving through the trees. Everything's more alive. God is not an idea, then God is a living reality.
Exactly.
Because I'm ripped open. Not that I wish heavy grief on people, but grief is there, and grief is healing. It's a built-in sense of how to respond to loss. it helps clean us out. But we live in a culture that's grief phobic. So we cry just a little bit. We try and be strong. I mean, we shut down for people and we don't grieve together. I mean, if nations at war could grieve together, there wouldn't be any war.
Exactly.
It's all the same pain. Everyone's losing things. Children are dying on both sides. But we look at the thing that's happening in Ukraine and Russia right now. It's not possible to have that shared grief, except maybe in very small ways. And that's been true throughout warfare, all through human history. My tribe versus your tribe. And that's what's still barbaric to me. That's still occurring amidst all our technological advances.
Yeah, agreed. And yeah. You said grief phobic. And you know what comes alive in my mind that moment is whether it's grief phobic or shame phobic or fear phobic or guilt phobic.
Yeah.
We're bloody feeling phobic. We're human being phobic. Because what is it to be alive? What is it to be human being but to be alive? So mm-hmm. we're talking about intimacy and sensitivity.
If we can't feel, then to us, it's like Reagan said one time famously, once you see one redwood, you've seen all the redwoods. You know, there's no sense of appreciation and felt connection with the world. We live in the natural world.
What's most interesting to me is the profundity and the simplicity of what we're talking about, Robert, which is how can we raise our children to be themselves rather than trying to teach them to be someone they're not? How can we raise
them to be ourselves? And our kids don't get to pick up the clue. Maybe they have to go through some suffering or difficulties so they can wake up to that. We can't protect our children from that.
Right. So it's the protecting of the children, actually, that's not serving them. That's the disservice.
Especially the overprotecting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to shield them from everything. It's like the Buddha's parents shielded him from seeing human suffering. So he looks out the palace window, he sees suffering, and then the story begins, and he transitions into being the Buddha. Over a period of a decade or so.
Yeah.
You can't, it's there. It's sitting there. There's so much suffering everywhere. Yeah. The messy chaos of life.
The messy chaos of life. Yeah. Well, I'm really enjoying this conversation. It takes me back to, you know, for me, a lot of ways where the men's work started for me. So I've got a lot of love in my heart for you, Robert, and all of your work and all that you're sharing. It's made a huge impact in my life, and I'm very grateful to you for that.
Yeah. So
thank you. Yeah.
Okay. It's been good.
It's been good, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. And where can men find you if they're listening to this conversation? Where can they can find
First,
you?
The simplest thing is robertmasters.com.
Okay. Robert, thank you. I really appreciate your time. Really.
Okay.
Lovely conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. Good seeing you. I'll see you again sometime.
Yeah. I hope so. Lots of love to you.
Okay. That's been, bye.
You lived your life like you want your life to be. Did you pass the blame, get lost on a runaway train?
The Privileged Man is a men's movement that we founded in 2021 to create safe and connected spaces for men to gather and remember how to speak the courageous language of their hearts to live more sovereign and truthful lives. Men are reclaiming the power to choose their way of being, guided by their innate wisdom in the place of societal dictates. A brotherhood of consciously connected men is forming, and we welcome you to join us. If you'd like to learn more about the brotherhood, please visit theprivilegedman.com, and we look forward to welcoming you.